Live News.
From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Nambi Show. It's Tech Tuesday. Call it the unforeseen consequences of the internet information explosion, websites and search engines like Google and LexisNexis rendering the old school research project and the search for the local pizza joint's phone number obsolete. No longer do we start in the dusty stacks of a university library or the mildewed phone book in our closet. Thanks to new databases, terabytes of knowledge, insights and data are only a click away. But could it be that we're losing something in the process? Some worry the convenience of today's information environment comes at a troubling cost. In fact, some worry it's making us stupid. This Tech Tuesday, we're speaking with thinkers from a broad range of specialties about our online habits and how they're transforming the way we research and the way we think. Joining us by phone from Carlisle, Massachusetts, is Nicholas Carr. He's a writer and author of the article, Is Google Making Us Stupid?, which appears in the July-August issue of Atlantic Magazine. Nicholas Carr, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kojo.
Also with us is James A. Evans. He joins us from the studios at the University of Chicago. He's a professor of sociology at the university, and his article, Electronic Publication and the Narrowing of Science and Scholarship, appears in the current issue of Science magazine. James Evans, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
Erica Linke is Associate Dean of University Libraries at the Carnegie Mellon University and President of the Association of College and Research Libraries. She joins us by phone from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you. Glad to join everyone today.
Alex Halavay is a professor of communications at Quinnipiac University. He joins us from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York City. Alex, good to talk to you again.
Glad to be here, Kojo.
Nicholas, allow me to start with you. Technology has clearly affected the way we live our lives, how we pay our bills, how we're entertained, and how we conduct research. But you say it's also transforming the way we think and maybe even the way our brains are wired. What do you mean by that?
I think one thing we know from neuroscience is that the human brain is very adaptable, very malleable. And we also know that reading, for instance, and patterns of other patterns of thinking aren't hardwired into our brain. They're not genetically determined. They're learned behaviors. And I think through history, when we see important new technologies that influence how we find and gather and interpret information, they can actually, those new technologies can actually begin to change at a very deep level the circuitry of our brain. And I think essentially we're learning or training our brains to think, to remember, to gather information in very different ways. And although, you know, it's too early to have proof of that happening at a biological level with the internet, I think there are some important clues out there that, in fact, the internet is beginning to have an effect on cognition and memory and other mental aspects of our lives.
James Evans, over the last few years, academic databases have gone digital and the number of articles available to researchers has skyrocketed. But in the most recent issue of the magazine Science, you document a paradox. Researchers are actually narrowing the sources they use in their work. Could you explain the focus of that article?
Sure. So I was interested in, you know, what's the effect of all of these academic journals and articles going online. And so I looked at a sample of 34 million of the most cited publications, and I looked at their online availability in terms of backfiles kind of coming online over the course of the last, 8-10 years. And I find that as more backfiles of these journals come online, that people that tends to influence people to cite them more recently and cite fewer discrete articles, and a greater concentration of those sites themselves are in actually fewer articles. Now, this, I should say, I'm controlling for a lot of other things. So this doesn't mean that scholarship and science in general is narrowing. I mean, there are other forces at work. There's more science that's available. There are more scientists and universities that are putting things out. So many of these things themselves are broadening. But when you look at the actual influence of online availability, it appears to kind of dampen, make more recent and narrow the number of things that end up getting actually picked up and used in science subsequently.
Is that what you mean by the depth of citation, that it's pretty shallow?
The depths of citation, just that the articles that are being cited in these things that go online are more recent when controlling for these other forces.
Nicholas, everyone seems to agree that search engines can enable lazy thinking, but you've taken this a step further, asking, as we mentioned earlier, whether Google is actually making us stupid.
Well, the first thing that needs to be said is that the Internet and search engines like Google are extremely compelling because they are so quick and so convenient, and that's why all of us use them, and certainly I find them very valuable in doing research. But I've come to see in myself, and many others have said similar things, particularly in the wake of my article, that I find it more and more difficult as my brain adapts to the kind of hopping around and hyperlinking that is so common on the Internet. I find it harder and harder to concentrate on, for instance, a long book or a long article, or just to be reflective or contemplative or to concentrate on a single train of thought. My brain keeps wanting to revert to the way it behaves when I'm online, which is, surfing from source to source, from bit of information to bit of information, and never going deep into any one. And so some people, that doesn't bother them, that we might be losing some of our capacity for concentration and contemplation. For me, I think those type of qualities of thought are essential to human identity and even human culture. So it makes me very nervous to think we may be sacrificing some of that in exchange for the various benefits we get by going online.
Alex Halavay, there's a common acronym that's used by people on the web with the letters TLDR, as in too long, didn't read. That seems to encapsulate the problem that Nicholas was just describing, doesn't it?
Oh, I think so, yeah. And it's easy to see TLDR as an indicator of intellectual laziness. But I disagree. I think that we can actually concentrate and be contemplative in a different sort of way. I think we're moving from the lecture to the seminar. And, hypertext is just another word for conversation. So I agree completely that the environment, the information environment we're in, affects the way we think. But I worry about the label of stupid in that it might encourage retrograde sorts of thinking about new media rather than a more kind of critical and contemplative approach to thinking about how this affects our thinking.
What do you mean by we're moving from the lecture to the seminar?
Well, I mean, I think that if you look at this kind of jumping from point to point and this sort of idea that that texts are much more readerly, that is, that they are much more oriented around the reader rather than the writer. So the writer can no longer command the attention in the way that, say, a novelist might have, in earlier years, that it moves to be more of a readerly text and that people are able to interact. I mean, we talk about this interactive technology, and it allows us to interact in our working through of problems and our thinking about the world.
So I guess, Nicholas, the argument here is that we're not getting stupid, we're just getting together, interactive.
I think what we're seeing is a change in the way we think. And it's true that there is speed and convenience online and there is interactivity. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't change the fact that we seem to be losing the ability to sustain concentration, whether it's reading something or just thinking through a line of thought. And so if you're saying that that's something worth losing because we gain more in exchange, well that's fine. I simply don't agree with that. It worries me. I don't think all thinking is a matter of interactivity and quickly sharing your ideas or jumping around. I think sometimes you actually want to engage in an extended piece of writing and follow the logic of an author or some other act of that kind of traditional contemplation. So as I say, you can take the view that what we're losing is less than what we're gaining. I don't share that view.
Erica Lenke, before my specific question for you, do you want to engage in the discussion that already having?
Did you hear me clearing my throat?
Yes, I did.
actually, all of this is, I think a lot about this because I've been in higher education for a long time, and I can see how different ways of engagement, different ways of engaging have changed over time. I think there's so much new group work these days that the whole idea of contemplation and reflection sometimes gets lost. It's interesting to think that we often refer to academic departments as disciplines, and in fact, that's also very telling because it does take discipline to focus. And I think we kind of sometimes miss that element in when we engage with students. The comment someone made about the influences of the internet. It's not just how people get information, but the multitasking that students and all of us may engage in allow for us to dip into different things and in some ways skip or to be shallow. I don't think we're less smart, but we have other tensions in our lives and other deadlines that encourage us to maybe move faster than we might have in the past.
I'd like to invite our audience to join the conversation at 800-433-8850. We're having a Tech Tuesday discussion on the relationship between information, knowledge, and our brains. 800-433-8850. How have new information technologies affected your critical thinking? Do you think smart searches lead to dumb researchers? 800-433-8850 is the number to call, or you can send email to koja@wamu.org. James Evans, is there a danger that we sometimes confuse quantity with quality, that we take the number of times an article, say, is referenced to somehow be a sign that the ideas in that article are stronger than, a more obscure article in a less prestigious journal?
Well, I think in general, quality signals that other people that we trust signal that something's valuable, that they cite something, are really eminently useful. But the problem, I think, comes, or the potential problem comes when you can imagine two things are cited almost equally, but one thing is cited maybe once more than something else, right? Or somebody just randomly, picks something and cites it. Then the next time, insofar as people can kind of see other people's choices or those choices are more transparent, the next time somebody picks something, they're going to pick the thing that somebody else picked. And so almost random differences in quality could magnify dramatically to the degree that people have more access to other people's choices and references. And I think that's one of the things that the internet is providing. It's providing a kind of more transparent view of what other people are picking. And so there's a quicker convergence as a result of that to particular ideas and articles. And so other things kind of disappear more quickly than before.
Erica Lenke, the convergence may be quicker, but it is my understanding that you feel it has always existed, that there's always been a bias for big journals ingrained into academia.
Well, no one library can own anything, so everybody selects what they think is most germane. So there's always an exploratory phase to what people are doing. What I wanted to comment on a little bit differently is we talk about things being on the internet, and I know from seeing students, and probably our other guests do too, that that there is a deeper web. That is, we have students who work here who somehow never kind of who don't understand that the library has licensed resources that they need to authenticate to get to. So what's open and available on the web may not completely reflect everything that's really available and in some instances what might be more valuable to the work that they're doing.
We're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, you can join the conversation. If you've already called, stay on the line. We will get to your call, or we'll try our best. If the lines are busy, send us an email to koja@wamu.org. It's Tech Tuesday, and we're talking about the information overload on the internet. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. You're listening to the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, it's Tell Me More from NPR News.
Next time on Tell Me More, Black in America, CNN's provocative new look at men, women, and family.
That makes you feel really good that now they're living our creed at home and in the community. That definitely makes our chest stick out a little bit more.
I'm Michelle Martin. Join me, CNN's Soledad O'Brien, and the Mocha Moms to talk about the new series, Black in America, next time on Tell Me More.
That's coming up at 2 on WAMU 88.5.
This week, WAMU 88.5 is doing maintenance work on its broadcast tower. This work has to be performed in the daytime between 10 and 3 o'clock. During this period, there will be no HD radio signals. These disruptions will only affect listeners with HD radios. WAMU 88.5's Channel 1 will continue to broadcast its analog signal and be available online at WAMU.org. BluegrassCountry.org and WAMU HD Channel 3 will also continue to be available online. We've scheduled 5 days for this work, but we hope it'll take a little less, depending on the weather. And thank you for your patience.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from CDWG. With thousands of technology products in stock, they're there to get public sector customers what they need when they need it on purchasing vehicles specific to their organizations. CDWG, the right technology right away.
Welcome back. It's a Tech Tuesday conversation on whether easier access to the Internet is affecting not only the way we conduct research, but the way we think. We're talking with James Evans, professor of sociology at the University of Chicago, whose article, Electronic Publication and the Narrowing of Science and Scholarship, appears in the current issue of Science magazine. Erica Linke is Associate Dean of University Libraries at Carnegie Mellon University and President of the Association of College and Research Libraries. Alex Halavay is Professor of Communications at Quinnipiac University. And Nicholas Carr is a writer and author of the article, Is Google Making Us Stupid? That article appears in the July-August issue of The Atlantic magazine. Let me go to Paul in Fairfax, Virginia. Paul, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Koji. Woo, on the air. Awesome. Okay, I'm a first year, I'm 24, but this is my first real semester at George Mason University. It's my first time at a big four-year, and I found myself intensely confronting for the first time in my life having to balance exactly what you guys have been talking about, which is it's what stunned me when I turned on my car radio just now, having to suddenly find a way to balance the wealth of information necessary for research at a moment's notice online versus, and I found it, I was half depressed, half reflective. We have a huge library called Stomach Library, and I never went to it once the entire semester. I walked in once, and it was to use my laptop. And I am just thinking about how you guys are putting this math balance that must be acquired, because I wondered if the quality of my research, whatever might be necessary for whatever projects at the time, was affected by the fact that I would do what would take me days before I do in half an hour. And I did notice kind of a cognitive laziness, almost a I knew that I could get information from scientific journals, from global affairs, headlines, you know, within half an hour. I do half an hour of research, hyperlink everything to my, like, bookmark all, go play games, and then come back later, the day before the project, go reference all the information I had already set aside, and in an hour, throw together a report that would get a B, as opposed to really working hard, you know, pouring through. And I did notice, I don't want to say a cognitive slowdown, but definitely a there's a separation of consciousness that goes on when you force yourself to pay attention to, like you said, paper-based media and sift through it all.
Paul, I suspect that you have influenced the next 40 minutes or so of this conversation. allow me to start with James Evans.
Hi, I'm sorry. So I think this is This is interesting. I'm sorry, my sound just kicked out, and so I didn't hear the last part of the conversation. But I think there's no question, at least, I mean, one of the things that, that I kind of hypothesize at the end of my article is that one of the chief beauties of bricks and mortar libraries and of print resources is that you actually do have to work harder. The indexing stinks. You know, you actually have to read the title and abstract. You have to actually flip through the article to kind of see if there's something that's relevant there for you. And in the course of doing that, it may not be individually efficient. It may not be individually efficient for the student or for the researcher, but it ends up doing a service potentially for science because then, you know, you're making links between things that wouldn't be made by the search engine. You're making analogies between things that wouldn't be made by the kind of the individual, you know, kind of linking through resources as they're already kind of wired together, you know, by hyperlinks or references. And I think that kind of poverty of indexing and old print resources had the potential impact of allowing researchers and students to kind of be forced to make connections that they wouldn't otherwise make.
And Nicholas Carr, let's think of Paul as a future Fortune 500 CEO, a future president, a future law professor. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think Paul's experience at school is becoming very much the norm. In the article, in the Atlantic article, I discuss some research that was undertaken by researchers at University College London who examined the logs of searches at research sites to try to document how people do research and gather information online. And what they found is that deep reading or any kind of sustained reading is extremely rare. And instead, what people do is what they call power browsing, which is jumping very quickly from headline to headline, from abstract to abstract, reading a couple of paragraphs here and there. But there's no evidence that people go back and actually read entire documents. And so obviously scanning is a very useful mental tool, and there's nothing wrong with it. But I think what we're seeing is the potential for scanning to simply force out other types of reading and other types of research, in particular deep reading, the kind of engagement that can, you know, that deep mental engagement with a text, for instance, where you simply immerse yourself in it. That's becoming much harder, particularly if you're using your laptop or your PC to get information, and it's surrounded by distractions, by emails coming in, instant messages coming in. So the long-term effects, you know, we don't know what it's going to turn into, but I fear that really we're losing a fundamental mental capability that has been around at least since the invention of the printing press 500 years ago.
I am particularly interested in hearing what the associate dean of university libraries said to a student who said, hey, I've never even been in the library. It takes me half an hour. I got to be.
Well, I would say, first of all, that if you define the library solely by the fact that it's a building, you're missing part of what a library is today. From the moment we've moved into the online world, libraries are now virtual in many ways, where the resources that we license for students are available from dorm rooms, from their offices, and in some instances, that if they're on the campus, they can actually slip into our licensed resources and not even realize it. So it doesn't shock me because I hear this even on our own campus. One of the things I kind of want to get back to, and I'm not sure how Paul would answer this or the others. Yes, the internet's out there. It's easy to get lots of information, whether you're on the open web or the deep web. But in education, aren't we ultimately trying to develop citizens or scholar citizens, student scholars, who have critical thinking skills, who can be problem solvers? I mean, do we also want to think about whether this actually helps the educational and learning process?
And Alex Halafay, you're the one handing out the A's, B's, and C's. Do you take into account the quality of the research? Can you assess from a student's paper how much time has been spent on research if that research has been done online?
Yeah, they're mostly C's. or lack of time that's been spent on it. And I think, you know, part of that is our fault because we kind of assume that students have been exposed to the same sort of learning environment that we were exposed to perhaps in high school and middle school. And a lot of them are coming into university having only written papers using sort of the open web materials when they were in high school. And so, yes, I think that we need to engage our students in new ways of discovery and of making use of these new texts. Whether we want to introduce friction to this sort of, you know, whether we want to make them walk uphill in snow both ways just because we did and because that's how we learned, I'm not sure that that's necessarily the best way to go, but we definitely need to provide them the scaffolding to be able to engage in these materials more critically.
Well, if I could interject,
please
I think
do.
That's something that librarians have noticed for a long time is the continuity of kids coming through K through 12 and coming to campus with an inadequate, maybe, sense of where to look and how to do research. And that's actually had a big change on what libraries are doing today, in addition to just working with collections, which are extremely important, and reference services. We've had to engage more in working with what I'd call sort of information literacy, for lack of a better word, bringing students an awareness of what it is, what research really means, what are the ways that they need to engage in order to do more than come up with a C paper.
Thank you very much for your call, Paul. Here now is Glenn in Alexandria, Virginia. Glenn, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks. It's a great topic, Kojo. I just have some observations from the publishing industry, which is affected by this a lot. I was back in the 80s. I was director of Smithsonian Books before they when they actually produced books instead of licensing them to other publishers. In the 80s, I remember getting working hard to get authors and editors to actually work on computers instead of writing and editing on paper manuscripts and carbon copies. If anybody remembers those days. But there were two essential functions in that kind of publishing, nonfiction publishing. One was substantive editing, and the other was fact-checking. Later, working at Time Life Books before it self-destructed, we hired a lot of fact-checkers because accuracy was very important. It got to the point where younger researchers simply would not use Time Life's extensive library. They actually sold it off. What troubles me now is when I read books in nonfiction from important trade publishers that there seems to be a lot of carelessness, not only grammatically but in the fact-checking itself. Part of that is economic, but I wonder if your people think that it also has to do with the fact that so much of this research and fact-checking is not done
well,
from primary sources.
Let me choose one of my people, as you described them. getting back to the point that Glenn made earlier, Nicholas Carr, about the fact that the writers were reluctant to use more modern methods of doing things. In your piece, you sketch a history of Luddites, whether it's Socrates' denunciation of written philosophy or others denouncing Gutenberg's printing press. On the one hand, those denunciations are absurd or seem absurd, but they also often prove to be true, didn't they?
Right. For instance, Socrates was made very nervous by the introduction of the alphabet, which, you know, made writing and reading possible. And he worried that it would erode people's memory, because obviously you wouldn't have to store inside yourself what you used to have to. You could just go to a book. And on the one hand, you know, he was right. I mean, it probably did erode the function of our memory. On the other hand, he didn't foresee the great benefits that the new technology of reading and writing would bring. And I think this is a theme which I call out in my article, because I think it's important to see both sides of the issue, that just as there's a lot of, you know, glorification of new technologies, there can be people who are made nervous by any new technology and they fail to see the long-term benefits. And so I think it's important to understand that, you know, there may be many unforeseen benefits coming from the Internet. On the other hand, what kind of makes me nervous is that a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, everything turned out okay with the alphabet or with the printing press, so everything will turn out with the Internet as well. I think that's an oversimplification. I think the Internet is something very, very different from previous technologies, and it has a much more dominant effect on the flow of information in general and into our minds. So, even though previous skeptics have been proven, you know, at least partially wrong, it doesn't mean that we should expect that everything that comes out of the internet is going to be grand.
You know, Erica, different academic disciplines have different traditions in terms of research methodology. A biologist, for example, pursues a research subject differently than a mathematician would. Isn't that correct?
Yes, and I think that is sort of going to how deep our citations. I think mathematicians, their predecessors are their near and dear friends, the way in other disciplines, sort of that connection to the past isn't as immediate. And talking about disciplines, when you're going into the visual and performing arts, that's a whole nother facet to information and the flow of it that challenges people in those disciplines in ways that the historical published scholarly record, it's very different for many of those people in the performing arts.
Allow me to go back to the telephones. Here is Michael in Washington, D.C. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Mr. Nandi. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
You're welcome.
I just have two comments I'd like to make. I come at this discussion from an interesting perspective because I am both a political science graduate student and I moonlight as a librarian. So I have a little bit of experience. And I'd just like to say two things. The first is that it seems that the panel somewhat frustratingly discusses this topic purely from anecdotal evidence. We hear over and over again these sort of grand terms of, well, we as a society don't appreciate information in the same way, and we are losing our cognitive ability to focus and read on different subjects. But it's all anecdotal.
Allow me to interrupt for 1 second and have James Evans tell you how he did his research. James?
So I did my research that shows that as basically more electronic journals come online and issues come online, that the citations become more recent and fewer things are cited. So there's a greater convergence. With a sample of articles, but it was a sample of 34 million articles over the course of the last 60 years basically the back files as they kind of go on from basically all the available online publishers as well as the kind of the free internet. So, but, I mean, it's just a sample. It's not perfect, but it's I don't know of a larger sample.
Yeah. Michael, that would be 34 million anecdotes.
Well, I mean, the issue here, I think, is that we need to actually look at this from sort of a neuroscience perspective as opposed to sort of the idea of, well, I heard earlier in the program the idea of, you know, that people are looking at pages for only a few minutes and there's no indication that they come back. Well, the point is that a lot of the research that I see done in our library is people will look at an article, read an abstract. If they like it, they'll take the article and download it. And, of course, there's no way to track reading of that particular article. So I just want to make sure that as a researcher myself, you know, we stick to the fact here and we don't sort of talk about this great decline in our cognitive ability.
This is Nicholas Carr. Can I just jump in here?
Please do.
I think it's a good point that we need to separate anecdote from scientific research. In the University College London study I talked about, they did actually very closely monitor people's behavior online and found that they rarely did actually go back. Even when they saved an entire document, there was no evidence that they went back and looked at it. But when we look at it, but to go to the neurological level, it's absolutely right that there's very little hard evidence right now of the effect of the internet on cognition because there simply hasn't been time to do the kind of longitudinal studies that are necessary. On the other hand, there has been a lot of research into, for instance, the ways that the brain will adapt to different types of reading. So somebody who reads ideograms, like a Chinese person, will have very different brain circuits for reading than does somebody like myself who uses an alphabet to read. So we know that the brain is very adaptable and will adapt in different ways to different media. So we can, you know, I think we can pretty strongly suspect that shifting to an online mode of reading and researching will have an influence on the neurological construction of our brain compared to sitting down with a book and reading it in a quiet room or whatever. So while it's true that we don't know exactly what's happening, I think we can say that something is likely happening, and I think we need to look at anecdotes and look at what people are going through, as well as the scientific evidence, to try to figure out what exactly is going on inside our brains.
Michael, thank you very much for your call. We're going to have to take a short break on this Tech Tuesday conversation, but we'll be coming back, so if you have calls, stay on the line. We'll try our best to get to your call, but you can still send an email to us at kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up at 1, hear stories of unsung Chinese heroes, like a peasant who fought the one-child policy and a newspaper man who revealed a big medical threat. We get insight on the upcoming Olympics and the prospects for democratic change in China through the lives of individual Chinese rabble-rousers. Today at 1 on the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. Then at 2 o'clock, it's Tell Me More from NPR News.
Next time on Tell Me More, Black in America, CNN's provocative new look at men, women, and family.
That makes you feel really good that now they're living our creed at home and in the community. That definitely makes our chest stick out a little bit more.
I'm Michelle Martin. Join me, CNN's Soledad O'Brien, and the Mocha Moms to talk about the new series, Black in America, next time on Tell Me More.
That's coming up at 2 on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Association of American Railroads. Today's freight railroads are committed to working hard for the environment by moving a ton of freight 436 miles on just 1 gallon of fuel. More online at freightrailworks.org. From the University of Maryland Baltimore County's Department of Information Systems, offering an online master's program in information systems. Applications for the fall semester are due August 10th. Information is online at ms.umbc.edu.
Welcome back to our Tech Tuesday discussion. We're discussing easier access to information on the internet and the effect it has on us. We're talking with Erica Linke, Associate Dean of University Libraries at Carnegie Mellon University and President of the Association of College and Research Libraries. Nicholas Carr is a writer and author of the article, Is Google Making Us Stupid? That article appears in the July-August issue of The Atlantic magazine. James Evans is a professor of sociology at the University of Chicago. His article, Electronic Publication and the Narrowing of Science and Scholarship, appears in the current issue of Science magazine. And Alex Halavay is a professor of communications at Quinnipiac University. Do many great research insights come from a process akin to marinating a steak? You compile a huge amount of information, you sort of allow yourself to stew in it, and occasionally come up with a useful set of insights. Is that how it's done, Erica?
Well, I'm not sure I'm the best. I'm not the greatest thinker on this call, but I do think that a time for sort of reflection and thinking about how things relate, just reading and doing isn't necessarily enough for the great insight. I think it's, I think research is not only having the information, but also using it and talking with, engaging others with the research and with the ideas.
James Evans, it may not be very efficient, but, you know, can marinating often lead to real revelations, breakthroughs that might not happen if you shorten or if you streamline your research?
I haven't studied marination in detail, although I'd like to.
Where are the cooks in this discussion? That's what I'd like to know.
I think there's no question that that being forced to read things that are tangentially related to your work allows you to make connections that wouldn't be made if you're searching, and if basically, you know, semantic search engines are looking for kind of similar words or words in a similar semantic space. So I think in that sense, it's clear that something's different's happening when things are more efficiently brought to your fingertips and you're not forced to essentially make these broader linkages that might integrate your work into a broader context. And yet at the same time, I think the real influence is that as people converge more quickly, more things kind of get dropped out of the conversation. And insofar as that is an influence of online availability, then I think that reduces the kinds of ingredients that would end up in your average marinade. So, in that sense, I think this is you know, insofar as kind of having broad, diverse sets of issues at everybody's not only fingertips, but actually kind of within their view, their vision, I think it may be that these technologies tend to reduce that.
I think Clay in Rockville, Maryland has an interesting point of view. Clay, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks, Kojo. First of all, I just want to say that when I was in college, I did quite a bit of marinating of my brain, and I don't think it helped my cognition very much at all. But seriously, you know, back when we started this program, I think it was Nicholas who mentioned that Google and the search engines that we have now encourage more shallow research into subjects, and I kind of have to disagree with that because oftentimes, you know, say you're researching public radio and you get to a certain section and it starts speaking about NPR. Well, you're encouraged to go ahead and just click on that link and, you know, learn a little bit more about NPR. So you're really getting deeper into the subject, in my opinion, for that. And then the second thing was about the depth of the read. And I might have been you again, Nicholas, but it was about people not reading the text deeply. And what I was thinking there was just that, you know, if you're researching a subject, then, you know, your goal is to get information on that subject, not necessarily to become familiar with the text about that subject. So if you are not necessarily reading one source, if you're encouraged to look at more sources, they may be a little bit more shallow, but more sources on the same subject, aren't you getting a deeper understanding of that subject?
Nicholas?
Not necessarily, no. And I don't think this is just about research, I should underline. I mean, a lot of what we've been talking about is in a scholarly or academic context. But, you know, the Internet is becoming the universal media for all of us, whether we're in school or outside, and it's how we gather information, how we make sense of the world, even increasingly. And, you know, it's certainly true that it gives us access to many types of information that used to be very difficult to find or expensive to find. But I think the very structure, the technological structure of the net, which is based on hyperlinks, which allow us to leap very quickly, as the caller said, from source to source and place to place, on the one hand, it does allow us to find things we might not have found otherwise, but it also encourages that very kind of superficial engagement with every piece of information.
Nicholas, you say it also, in a way, encourages us to go quickly from site to site for short information bursts. And that way, we click on multiple pages, and guess what? We're viewing more advertising.
Right. I mean, you know, another thing I talk about in the article is that this mode of gathering information, what I call an intellectual ethic, is not only built into the technology of the net, it's built into the business strategies of companies like Google and most other internet companies. They make money through two basic ways. One is showing us advertisements linked to content, and the other is gathering information about what we look at. And both of those are optimized when we look at as many pages, as many kinds of information, as many sources as possible, as quickly as possible. So I think even the economic incentives of the big internet companies push us toward this very high-velocity engagement with information and kind of push us toward distraction and away from deep reading, deep engagement, reflection, and contemplation.
We got an email from Bradley in Washington, D.C., that I'd be interested in hearing you respond to. Well, both Alex and Eric, or for that matter, anybody else. Bradley says, in addition to lazy research, I see more and more often references to Wikipedia, which is an open source encyclopedia, does not have the academic verification necessary for authentic information. Not only are we leaving the library behind, but we're relying too much on others' opinions for verified information. To me, this leads to dumbing down our research and even communications. Too often, we are all receiving biased and unconfirmed email messages purporting to educate us about a product, candidate, or event. On the other hand, with sites websites like Wikipedia, some people have seen evidence of what they call the wisdom of crowds, that groupthink can produce data that is surprisingly accurate about complex issue areas. Where do you see that fitting into this? First, you, Erica Linke.
Well, I think Wikipedia is a mixed blessing. I mean, it picks up many arcane subjects that that people want to know something about. But like with all information, if you just sort of leave it where you get it and don't ask hard questions about the reliability of the source and so forth, it won't really serve your needs. I think that's one of the things that all of us, when we're talking about the internet dumbing people down, I mean, are people really thinking about as information? Are they information literates? Information savvy users of the internet, whether you're a student or anyone else, are you questioning what you're reading, or are you taking everything at face value? And I think that's something that we all grapple with.
Alex?
Well, I think Wikipedia is actually a search engine. And, you know, it may be that Google does what Google does way too well. Robert Merton wrote a great book on serendipity and the role of serendipity in kind of the development of thought and knowledge. And Google may just take you to the place, and I think Professor Evans' work kind of points to this happening in academic work, but in general, in the broader sense of knowledge, Google may point you towards stuff that is directly on key. And Wikipedia tends to, there's this idea of wandering around Wikipedia and bumping into things. And I think we need more of that kind of jumping around, not less. I think we need that kind of bumping into ideas that we didn't expect, that kind of friction in browsing. And so that kind of sociable form of search, not a search driven by an engine, but by other people, I think is a worthwhile way to go. And I think it's helpful if you think of it as a search engine, as something that leads to other stuff and not as a destination.
Here is Martha in Bethesda, Maryland. Martha, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm an MCPS middle school teacher, and I can tell you that we...
MCPS would be Montgomery County Public Schools, for those of our panelists who are in other locations.
And our media specialist makes an effort to really broaden the scope of research, and so we tell the kids not to use Wiki. We keep them off the computers oftentimes at the early stages of research. But before I go reread my copy of The Time Machine, I just respectfully suggest that perhaps some of our cognitive abilities are correlated to age, because I'm currently taking a college class with my daughter, and I know that my concentration ability is very different from the way it was half a lifetime ago.
You sure you're not competing with your daughter here?
No, we're not competing. Anything but.
Care to comment on that, Nicholas Carr?
You know, I think it's certainly wise to point out that we need to be careful about drawing too strong a correlation between cause and effect. But I think there's actually considerable evidence that people's ability to be attentive and to concentrate actually gets better as they get older. So I don't think age necessarily explains it. And also, you know, what I've been interested to see in the wake of my article is the very broad response from people who have similar feelings that I do, that they find it increasingly difficult as they use the net more to move away from the net and immerse themselves in a long piece of reading or a long piece of thinking. And this is from people, you know, of all ages. So it's true that it's anecdotal, but the breadth of the phenomenon seems pretty striking to me.
Thank you very much for your call, Martha. We got an email from Cecilia in Washington who says, frankly, the topic of this conversation is a little silly. As a graduate student working on getting a master's in library science, the issue of the abundance of information available online is often over-discussed and it gets tiring. Personally, I am thankful for the convenience of credible sources on the internet, as I do not live on campus and do much of my paper writing at my desk at home. I resent the attitude that assumes that students of my generation do not have the ability to discern good scholarly information from information that should be taken with a grain of salt. Additionally, in everyday life, I enjoy the fact that when I encounter an unfamiliar name or historical event, etc., I can merely type it into Google to at least gain a basic understanding of it, when before I would merely check it off as something else. I don't know. I have the feeling many students of my age would agree with this. Well, I can tell you, Cecilia, we got a call from Paul earlier in the broadcast who described himself as a freshman student who talked about spending half an hour on papers and getting a B on it. Erica, isn't there a danger that with increasingly sophisticated databases that can think for researchers, students may never have to learn how to conduct rigorous searches?
Well, I think that's I think that's an ideal that we've always had, that students do conduct rigorous searches. I think one of the things we did here at Carnegie Mellon once, we did a survey of graduate students to find out where they began doing their research. And one of the first place, the first place they went to was their faculty advisor. And the library was sort of down in the list of things. But education is not just the library's business. It's the institution's business. And it's really collaborating with faculty and with the library and with the students that we're going to end up with students who have the right outcome, which is critical thinking skills, a good way to assess things. Cecilia, the young woman who called in, I wish we had more students like her, but there are, students are a complex group of from individuals, and some of them do have good sense and good ways and good skills in understanding the research and the information they're getting. Not everyone is like that, and of course I think I'm at all universities and colleges that this is something both faculty and librarians face on a daily basis.
Erica Linke reminding us that students are in the final analysis, not an amorphous mass. They are individuals. Erica Linke is Associate Dean of University Libraries at Carnegie Mellon University and President of the Association of College and Research Libraries. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Alex Halavay is Professor of Communications at Quinnipiac University. Alex, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
James Evans is Professor of Sociology at the University of Chicago. His article, Electronic Publication and the Narrowing of Science and Scholarship, appears in the current issue of Science magazine. James Evans, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Nicholas Carr is a writer and author of the article, Is Google Making Us Stupid? That article appears in the July-August issue of The Atlantic magazine. Nicholas Carr, good to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And you can find links to all of those articles at our website, kojoshow.org. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Namdi Show, a local government spies on its own citizens. What's behind recent revelations that the Maryland State Police targeted peace activists and anti-death penalty groups? Plus, the new head of Virginia's GOP on his strategy for the fall campaigns and how discontent among the Commonwealth's Republicans helped him win his job. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt.